Hello everyone. Today we are going to see we are going to review the main concepts of Unit 2, Words and Word Boundaries. Let me see. Okay. So what we are going to see in this unit, some basic notions about the different levels of linguistic analysis, especially focusing on morphology and its interaction with semantics. We are going to see how there is an interconnection between the different levels of analysis and also especially the connection between morphology, semantics, and other disciplines, and how this is the basis for the applications of semantics and morphology, such as creating corpora, thesauri, lexical, and conceptual databases, etc. But first of all, we will see some basic notions about word formation phenomena, which are very important in morphology. So they are the basis to understand words. Okay. How is morphology interconnected to all other disciplines of linguistics? Well, the first one who started dealing with this was Hans Marchand, already in the 70s. Well, already, quite recently, in fact, because many disciplines date from centuries ago, and however, linguistics is quite a modern science, as you know. From Saussure to Hans Marchand, we had to see 50 or 60 years passed through until somebody started talking about morphological and morphology, theory of morphology. So it stopped having a marginal role and it started to get more important position in linguistics. Kastowski, also from the 70s, his students, is a big name in morphology, is the one who analyzed zero derivation, which we will see later on. Well, there are two basic methods in the science of language to apply to this science of language, to morphology, the synchronic and the diachronic. And Marchand's method was both synchronic and diachronic. For him, the main purpose is synchronic, which is the description of present-day English word formative types. So he analyzed the words in the present, and he tried to find principles that could explain where they could from. It obviously, word formation studies are connected to diachronic methods of language, which are historical methods to see the evolution of these words through time, because sometimes we need to real proof of this. Obviously, word formation phenomena is a phenomenon that happens a long time. So what we are going to see here, because diachronic methods, we cannot see you, we see this in other areas of the degree. We will see what the tools are to analyze linguistic phenomena on the at present, with what we see. So synchronic analysis of word formation phenomena, which is, as I said, something from Marchand and then his follower Kastowski, can be transparent or non-transparent, or what is also called opaque word formation phenomena. This is what Marchand Kastowski called zero derivation, and also Marchand. Transparent word formation phenomena are very obvious. We have, for instance, drive and driver and driving. Obviously, we see here that there are suffixes. The suffixes er or ing show that these words come from drive, okay? Zero derivation or opaque transparent word formation, non-transparent word formation phenomena or opaque word formation phenomena are phenomena where we have two words that are homophonous, for instance, bus as an object or bus as a verb, but they don't have any difference in shape, so we need to know what comes first. Marchand, in order to analyze these concepts, these phenomena, he created some criteria. Form-related criteria or content-related criteria or content-dependent criteria. Content-dependent criteria are criteria that are based on the content, as the word says, the inner part of the word. Within these content-dependent criteria, we have the principle of semantic dependency, which says that the word that for its analysis is dependent on the content on the other pair member is necessarily the derivative. This sounds complex, but it is very simple. For instance, we have so as the noun or so as the verb. We use so an object. So to so as an action is to cut something. So we need the word so to understand the meaning of the verb. Then obviously the verb is derived from the noun. Drink, what would we say? Drink is the noun and drink is the verb. Or drive. According to this principle, if we say to have a drink, drink is to have a drink, drink would be in this case the noun. The base. And with drive, it could be also the base. But in this case, it's not like that. Because drinken, the verb comes first. And in drive, it's also first the verb. So this content, this principle of semantic dependency is not always, let's say, according to this principle, mostly we will have nouns that derive into words, verbs, but sometimes it's not exactly like that. We can have a verb that derives into a noun or, for instance, to drink a drink. We drink something. We drive. It's more difficult to explain when the derivative is the verb. Okay, the noun. What do we do then when we have some doubts? Because sometimes we see it very clearly, like in so, okay? Sometimes we don't see it as clearly, but we can have the intuition or the idea that, for instance, Rodeo Drive, a drive, is an area where we drive quickly. It's not like a road. A drive is a place like a road where cars drive quicker and there are more cars than pedestrians, etc. So there we could say, okay, then drive is the verb, the base, and drive as a noun has been formed out of the verb. But when there is no such a clear difference, we will go to the other principle. So we need all the principles to comply in order to make sure, or at least one has to be very, very certain. And this is the principle of semantic range. What does the principle of semantic range say? Then when there are two homophonous words, which is the two words that have the same shape and sound the same, the derivative will be the most specific word, the most hyponymic word. The more specific word is the derivative. And the most general word, the word that is more an umbrella term than the other word, is the derivation, the base word. For instance, we drink and we drive. What is more general? The verb of drink or the idea of a drink? Or we drive. What is more general? The idea of driving or a specific concept, which is a specific type of road or street that has certain features that makes us call it drive. So in this idea, according to this principle, drink as the verb and drive as the verb will be the base words and the derivatives will be the nouns. And then we have form-related criteria. This form-related criteria I have obtained from Stegauer. Stegauer explains them in his work from 2000s, but these criteria are derived from Marshan and then from Kastowski. Okay, we have the principle of phonetic shape, the principle of morphological type, and the stress criterion. The principle of phonetic shape says that a certain phonetic shape may put a word into a definite word class. This is a very simple principle. For instance, meant. Meant is a typical noun suffix. So all the very few verbs that end in meant will be derived from word, from nouns, because meant is a typical noun suffix. So for instance, ferment, torment is supposed to derive from a noun, okay? Because normally meant is typically associated to nouns. So all the words derived from a suffix that is associated to a specific category will be derived from that category. That's the, what it says, the principle of phonetic shape. Then we have the principle of morphological type. This principle says that morphological type is indicative of the primary or derived character of the composite words. It means the word class. For instance, in compounds, mostly there is a tendency of the for the head of the compound to be on the right. Mostly the compound head is on the right. And this noun is prototypically the base. So in general, in compounds, the right will be the base word, and it will be a noun. We have, for instance, lunch break, blacklist, babysit. What happens here? That this is an exception. In babysit, we also have exceptions. So then when this principle doesn't comply, we need to see if the other principles comply. Babysit is an exception because according to this principle, sit should be a verb, a noun, most typically. Because most typically the head is on the right and the base is typically a noun. But there are exceptions. For instance, babysit. Babysit is a verb and the base sit is the base is a verb, is not a noun. So in this case, baby will be the main, the head of the compound, but it will be on the left. Okay. But, well, no, sorry. In baby seat, always the head of the compound is on the right. This is what gives the category of the compound in this case. But in this case, it is a verb. So there is an exception as opposed to the other compounds, such as lunch break. If we have to see decide whether break is a noun or a verb, we will consider it most typically a noun, because lunch break, the word is a noun. So the head, the base has to be a noun also. And then we have the stress criterion, which is the most complicated one, but it can also work combine all these reasonings. In case of compounds, it says that the stress is sometimes indicative of directional relationship between a substantive and a verb. We have different kinds. We have compound verbs with locatives. This applies for this type of verbs that are compounds with locative expressions, locational expressions. For instance, underestimate, interact. In this case, we have a middle stress and the heavy stress. As you can see in underestimate, under is the middle stress and the big stress is the one in the base. Underestimate. Interact. So here we have to pay attention to the heavy stress. The heavy stress is in the second part. So we can see then that the verb is the base of the compound. It is the head, and then in the word that takes the middle stress will be the complements in this case. In the case of compound nouns, the heavy stress, for instance, is in the first element. So we have outhouse, underwear, undercurrent. When, so compound nouns that have that are nouns, that are compound nouns and not compound verbs, we can distinguish between from compound verbs with locatives, compound nouns with locatives versus compound verbs with locatives, because in general we are saying compound verbs verbs will have the heavy stress on the verb, whereas with compound nouns, the heavy stress will be on the locative particle. So in the case of verbs carrying this pattern, when we have verbs that carry this pattern, we can understand, because of this tendency, that they are derived from nouns. So when verbs have the pattern of the heavy stress being on the prefix, let's say on the locative particle, we can guess, or we can derive from that, we can conclude that they come from nouns. So we can determine that they are the derivatives of nouns. Let's see some practical example, a bit easier. To see the derivative chain of words, here we have a transparent example. For instance, go, going, outgoing, okay? Let's see how we can distinguish what is first, in going, going or outgoing. According to the phonetic shape, obviously, going, ing, is a typical example of adjective. So, according to this principle, we can say that outgoing is an adjective. And if outgoing is an adjective, we could say that the prefix out, because of the verb of the adjective, has been added to the adjective afterwards. According to the stress criterion, we will say that we say outgoing. So, as we have said before in the previous slide, compound verbs with locative particles have the stress pattern middle stress, heavy stress. So, in this case, we will say have the middle stress here outgoing. He's outgoing, outgoing. In this case, we can say that outgoing can be is a noun where if it is a noun, it could be outgoing, but if we turn it into a verb, we will say outgoing. So in this case, the verb would be derived from the noun, as we have said before. So when we have these patterns in verbs, we can say that they are derived from nouns. But in these compound verbs, what basically the base here, we can see that it is the verb go, okay, because it has the heavy stress, and the heavy stress goes on the verb. Okay. And then finally, according to the stress criterion. And finally, we have the morphological type. In these morphological types, the morphological criterion says, according to the morphological type, most compound forms come from nouns. This, in this case, does not apply, because the verb is a go, is go. It is a verb, it's not a noun. In this case, the derivative chain would be go, at go, at going. Why do we know that it does not apply? Because if we put into practice other criteria, for instance, the frequency criteria, we will see what the most, let's say that the most used, the more a word is used, the more derivations it can have, the more general it will be, and the less uses it has. This is a trick in order to finally check whether all these principles apply. For instance, a clear example would be, let's check what is what. We check on Google. It's a very simple example. We check on Google, outgo. And we look in Google for outgoing. Outgoing will be much more frequent than outgo, which means that outgoing is the most derived word and the likely the compound the derived word that this is a more used word because it is an existent word and more frequent word. Now we check for this chain. We check going and then we check outgoing again. We can see that going has a lot of results, more than outgoing versus outgo. So it is quite likely that going is the derivative base of outgoing. So when we have a doubt whether in this case it could be between outgo and outgoing and going, sorry, what is the base of outgoing, going or outgo? The most frequently used term will be the base. Okay. We have, for instance, breathtaking, heartbreaking, heartbreaker. In this case, we have breath, we have take, and we have taking. This is complicated because they are compounds. With compounds, it's not that it's not as easy as with derivatives to see what comes first. Because, if, for instance, if we apply the frequency criterion, breath will be very frequent, take will be very frequent, taking also. But if we check breath take and we compare it to taking, what will be most frequent? Then we can check and we see that breathtake is not an actual word. So, obviously, first we will have take, then taking, and then finally we have added this modifier, which is breath. Take, taking, breathtaking. With heartbreaking, the same. Okay. We will see more about derivation in Unit 3. In this case, the most important idea, even if it looks quite complex, is to see that there are different types of derivation, that the synchronic method started to be applied in the 70s with the father, thanks to the father of modern morphology, which is Hans Marschall in the 70s. His follower was Kastowski, and then Steckauer in the recent years has also worked more on what is called lexical morphology, that they work on synchronic analysis of derivational phenomena. Synchronic analysis means that they look at the derivational phenomena at the present without checking, of course, sometimes it's impossible not to check about their evolution through history, which is diachronic linguistics, which you have in other courses. And then they try to devise some principles. Some of them are content dependent, others are form dependent, to see how they can distinguish a derived word from a non-derived word. Especially this is difficult with opaque for word formation phenomena. When there is opaque word formation phenomena, we only have one thing, which is content-related criteria, which is base ourselves on the meaning of one or the other in order to see which one comes first. When we have transparent word formation phenomena, we can also apply, apart from that, we will also include the form-related criteria, which will help us distinguish which one can be derived from the other. According to Steckauer, most derivation, if, especially in compounds, this applies almost 100%, which is compounds tend to have to do with nouns. But when we have compounds related to verbs or with adjectives or adverbs, it is not that they do not always apply 100%. So it is good to combine all the principles, both form-related criteria and content-related criteria. And then if one word complies with two principles and not with one principle, then we can try to guess what works or what do not. Nowadays, it is always very easy to use all the criteria together, especially because we have the internet. And before they didn't count on this, now I just proposed also another criteria, which is the frequency criteria. The more hits a word will have on Google, the more basic it will be. The more frequent it will be means that it will be the base for higher derivations. If we check a word in the chain, we create the derivational chain, and we think, heartbreak, let's see, or break, or in this case, heartbreaker. What comes first, breaker or heartbreak? We can check also through frequency what we can think it can be the derivation from one or the other, but it will not always be certain. And sometimes we need to recur or resource to diachronical linguistics and to see what the exact origin of the word was. Okay. So this is the summary of the previous section. And now we are going to go very briefly into the basic concepts of the main approaches to linguistic semantics. We have lexical semantics and truth conditional semantics. Lexical semantics studies one unit, word unit, which is the lexicon. Words are considered to have meaning on their own, and sentences from this approach are approached as combinations of words. There are some problems. For instance, what happens with empty words in "it is raining," or even "there is nothing in the fridge," this "there is." In lexical semantics, which deals with word meaning and interplays with morphology and deals with word grammar. So both of them are interconnected here. Grammar of the word and the lexicon. Word grammar is connected to word meaning. Word grammar, word meaning, and words are considered to have grammar on their own. However, these small words, such as are considered empty words, are not part of the study of this discipline, because this is part of the study of the other discipline, which is truth conditional semantics, or what is considered conditional formal semantics. Because here, the unit of study is not the word on its own, it's the sentences. This doesn't mean that lexical semantics doesn't approach sentences, or that truth conditional semantics doesn't approach words. It means that the main unit of study for each of them is different. For the truth conditional semantics, the main unit of studies is sentences. And then the context of words will be defined in terms of their contribution to the sentence. So these empty words will have a function in the sentence. And then they have a right to live, let's say, to exist, and they are analyzed also through formal semantics. And this is the discipline of semantics that is mostly derived from formal logic and philosophy, and is based on the notion of truth as philosophy or formal logic. So it is very different from lexical semantics. Sometimes we can combine with both approaches or both studies, but here I want you to see clearly the difference between the both disciplines, because in the end, their unit of analysis is so different that everything that they study will be very, very different. If we focus on lexical semantics, which is what we are going to study here in this course, we focus on lexical semantics, basically, and especially in this unit, because we are dealing with morphology. Morphology is word grammar, which is what lexical semantics also studies, sometimes from another point of view. We focus on words and word boundaries. So there are some concepts that are important for you to know, which are these ones: lexeme, stem, and lemma. So let's see the definitions of each of these concepts. Word is a lexical item. When you read somewhere, this lexical item or lexical unit is synonym of word. And it is a concrete and specific unit of morphological analysis. We have some examples: car, driver, sun, sunny. Here are lexical items. And we analyze the word as an entity and as an independent entity. Then we have lexeme, which is a basic lexical unit of language. And it can be one or several words. it is not concrete, it is abstract unit of lexical analysis. For instance, drive is the lexeme of several words, of driver, driving, drives, drop. So it is abstract. It is abstract because it contains within this drive all the possible formations of a lexical unit which has the base drive. And in order to distinguish a lexeme from a word, we use capital letters. So for a lexeme, we will use capital letters, okay, in order to distinguish from the word. And then we have lemma also. Lemma is the canonical form, a dictionary form or citation form of a set of words, that is, of a lexeme. So, a lemma is how we cite that lexeme, how we cite that word, how we put it in the dictionary. And it has a special significance in highly inflected languages in order to observe word formation and inflectional processes. So it is also very important for the process of dictionary writing or the compilation of lexicographical, lexicological, terminological work, because the process of determining the lemma for a given lexeme is called lemmatization. Lemmatization. So when we have a group of words and then we say, okay, this is the lexeme. This is the lexeme for drive, is the lexeme for driver, driving, drived, drove, driven. These are all the possible forms of the lexeme drive, the idea of drive, the abstract unit lexeme. How we are going to put it in this terminological database? We are going to write drive. It has to be the same. It's the same as in capital letters in this case, because we have decided that in order to cite that lexeme, we are going to use drive and we don't need to write it then in capital letters, okay? We will lemmatize it and we will say the lemma of drive is drive and we write it down. So it can be an inflected form. It is an inflected form and it's the head, okay? So it represents all the inflected word forms of a given root and it when used independently in a dictionary. And then we have to distinguish between root and stem, because sometimes they are confused. Root is the central free morpheme, which has the content to which other bound morphemes are added, so as to form a word. And stem is the portion of strings that are common in all the inflections of a word. So it is a form to which affixes can be attached. So let's see an example. For instance, for the word drivers. Drivers. In the word drivers, the lexeme will be drive. In the case of a lexeme for all everything, it will be drive. But the lemma in this case is not drive. It is driver, because this the word that we will include in the dictionary. In the dictionary, besides the lexeme, within the lexeme drive, we have also driver, driving, drive. So we have the derivatives, etc. So how are we going to, we will obtain different lemmas, many lemmas. One of the lemma, in this case, from drivers, the one that comes exactly before is driver. Driver has a position in the dictionary. It is a lemma for the dictionary. So the lemma in this case is driver. The stem means the stem has to be a free morpheme, which is what distinguishes especially, the stem has to be also a free morpheme, but it is the most common word from which we will have all the derivations. In this case, it will be driver. From driver, we will have drivers, in this case, or drivers, or driver, because especially in English, we don't have the distinction of gender. We will have a plural distinction. It is not so inflected as other language. So with the stem will be driver. But the root is drive. From the root, so the root goes even before the stem, okay? Because from this root, this is the root from which all the lexemes, the lemmas will stem. And from there, we will be able to establish the base. So one thing is, the root is more connected to the idea of base. The base of driver is drive, okay? And from drive, without the E, we will have driving, driver, drive, etc. Okay, here you have some interesting links, which I would recommend you to check, because it's a very, very interesting database. Nowadays on the internet, we have amazing amount of those who are doing the final, the bachelor thesis with me know, because I always give you a document with database, which contains hundreds of applications to study, meaning corpus linguistics, related to corpus linguistics, lexical linguistic terminology, terminography, etc. Apart from this, we have, for instance, Lexicologos is an example of a comprehensive set of resources for the study of languages of the world. So it's a very interesting resource if you are interested to check morphological items from different languages of the world, okay? As you can see here, well, it is in French, but you probably it is quite understandable, and also you can always translate it with DeepL or Google Translate, etc. So I include that because it's a very interesting resource. And then we have some theoretical context, recent ones from Prandi, for instance. Prandi says that the lexicon, which are theoretical concepts that are interesting for you to also handle. Prandi talks about two kinds of concepts within the lexicon of natural language. The two types of concepts, according to him, are endocentric concepts or exocentric concepts. What is the difference between them? First, endocentric concepts says that there are concepts whose identity depends on specific lexical structures, which means that they are more language specific. And they provide a useful bridge between natural language and specialized language, between lexical and terminological research. So let's say that endocentric concepts are more proper, are studied among terminologists and among all those who study languages for specific purposes, specific areas of language. Endocentric, endo, as you know, means inside, internal. For instance, interesting lexical structures would be how Aboriginal languages of Australia express directions, because I have read somewhere that they have the very specific prepositions to mean, for instance, in going up the mountain, surrounding the mountain, things like this that are specific of their languages because they have to do with the reality, okay? So this would be endocentric concepts. And then we have exocentric concepts, which have who are deeply rooted in the independent categorization of shared things of experience. It comes to say that we have concepts that are universal, which are more universal. For instance, the concept of mother, are more cross-linguistic. The concept of father, the concept of mother, the concept of death, the concept of being born. These type of concepts are exocentric concepts, cross-linguistic, cross-cultural, and they are more related to universal categories. Okay? And then we have this schema, which is a very simple schema. It's adapted from Dick, who was the founder of the, you have probably seen this in other courses, the founder of the theory of functional grammar, afterwards followed by the Amsterdam School with Hengeveld, Mackenzie, etc. And he, in his book, his big blue book about the theory of functional grammar, in the introduction, he has this schema, which is very visual and interesting. He says that each level of linguistic analysis is contained by the next one, okay? So phonology, which has to do with the sounds, phonology and phonetics, with sounds, will be also part of the study of morphology, or is included within the level of morphology. And then we will have syntax. From syntax, we will go to semantics, and from semantics, we will go to pragmatics. The more outside we go of the circle, the more we are connected to the people, to the idiosyncrasies, which means that all, for instance, in phonology is more universal than morphology, and is more universal morphology than syntax, and syntax is more universal than semantics. Semantics will include more endocentric concepts, and pragmatics will be much more endocentric. Phonology will be much more exocentric, which means, for instance, clear example, all the languages in the world are based on phonemes. And there are some phonemes that are universal, and then there are some languages that have phonemes that we, other languages don't have. But some rules, such as the discrete, the recursivity of language, that we have a limited amount of sounds which would form a specific and unlimited number of sentences, the shape of our mouths and our vocal cords, etc., is universal. So phonology will be much more universal, even if it is expressed and manifested in different languages in different ways, than morphology. Still, morphology is quite universal, because there will be languages that are more or less inflected. There are different types of languages according to this, but the, even that, though there are different types of derivation and levels of inflection, we have certain phenomena that are quite universal, such as derivation, the evolution of language, language change, etc. So this has to do with morphology. Syntax, you all know about Chomsky. Chomsky talked about the universal grammar. Well, universal grammar, which is a grammar that we all have inside because we are born with this capacity, and languages manifest this grammar in different ways. That's the surface structure, not the deep structure. But then we go to semantics. Semantics has to do more with, is what gives us the idea that language is a conceptual phenomenon, which I always say, because semantics has to do with capturing the reality and putting names to the, to that reality and giving, making sense of that reality. So in semantics, we will start analyzing the meaning of these sentences. And many times, semantics will also have to do not only with lexical semantics, which is the one that is more connected to word syntax, but with formal semantics, which is more connected to truths. We'll analyze there are truths that are universal truths, logical semantics, etc. But we will also have, for instance, cognitive linguistics, which has to do with proverbs, metaphors, the cognitive mechanisms that help us structure the world in different ways and express it in different ways, in a figurative way. So this has to do a lot with cultures. It is more idiosyncratic. So the more we go outside the circle, the more it is connected to different manifestations, cultural manifestations of languages. And finally, pragmatics, which has to do with how users use language for their own, to mark their own benefit, intention and meaning. It's totally idiosyncratic and cultural based. So the more outside the circle we go, the more idiosyncratic manifestations of language we have, the more inside the circle, the more universal and endocentric concepts we will have. Okay? It says adapted here because I included these arrows, meaning that in this case, it's not only that syntax is over morphology, it is that morphology, because depending on the inflection in languages, which is morphology, influences a lot on the word order. We will see this in Unit 3. A language that is highly inflected, which has a lot of, means that the language includes most grammatical information words themselves. For instance, in Spanish, compared to English, we have a very lax word order compared to English because our words already give grammatical information to the sentence. However, the syntax of English sometimes is more fixed because the words have lost their inflectional capacity and they are more neutral, let's say. They don't show gender. Many times they don't even show plural. So when a language is not inflected at all, when there are languages that have no inflection, then we need to give the grammar of the word, the meaning, the structure is taken over by syntax. That's why I say that it is interconnected, because depending on the morphology, the syntax of a language will be much more strict or less. And here we have the units of analysis being more specific. For instance, in graphemes, for in graphics, the subsystem, phonemes and phones and phonemes for phonology, morphology studies morphemes and base morphemes, affixes. Then we have syntax, which studies the arrangements of words into phrases, clauses in sentences, the word order, and then semantics, which is expresses meanings. And here we have already an analysis of morphemes, lexeme phrases when we talk about lexical semantics. Okay, so semantics, let's say that also takes a lot from morphology, especially because words contain meaning. Okay. How do we find morphology in dictionaries? Well, in the fields of computational linguistics and applied linguistics, a morphological dictionary is a linguistic resource that contains correspondences between surface form and lexical forms of words. So we can have morphological dictionaries, okay? So surface forms of words are those found in natural language text, and the corresponding lexical form of a surface form is the lemma, followed by grammatical information. Okay, so for instance, in English, give, gives, giving, gave, and given are surface forms of the verb give. This is a definition of Wikipedia. The lexical form would be give, verb. There are two kinds of morphological dictionaries, morpheme aligned dictionaries and full form dictionaries. I recommend you check this webpage. I always say that we have to stop demonizing Wikipedia as a source of knowledge, because Wikipedia contains a lot of useful information. The only thing we need to do is to be critical on what we find. And if we see that the page is not well written, it has mistakes, the sources are not really serious, then we can have some doubts about this page. But nowadays, knowledge is everywhere. And it's not about going to a specific source that is going to ensure that this has high quality. Sometimes we can find good quality in a magazine, in a journal, in a mass media journal, but we need to develop some criteria that helps us distinguish what has quality and what has not quality. Okay, so for instance, in this case, the definition of a morphological dictionary is interesting in Wikipedia. Here is just an example of all the amount of lexicological resources that we can have, but there are many, many, many. We have British National Corpus, which is for Corpora Linguistic Data Consortium, the SELEX corpus. Unfortunately, it is not free anymore. The English corpora we have, for English corpora, we have the CORCA corpus, Corpus of Contemporary American English. We have a database for Old English, which is called NERTHUS, created in the University of La Rioja. WordNet, Lexilogos. There are many, 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 many. I recommend you go and check in order to put this into practice, just to see the usefulness of them, to navigate on all the, and I also invite you to look for other sources, obviously, as many as you can, and see whether you can understand them, whether you cannot understand them. As I said, nowadays we have hundreds of resources, and as happens with knowledge, the important thing is to be able to be critical on what we find, and be able to identify good quality from low quality. But all these resources are always developed by universities. So in the case of lexicological resources, the most important is to invest some time in checking them and seeing how they work and applying our theoretical knowledge, what we have seen here, to using them, okay? To being able to use them and to see how we can make a use of them, which is very, it comes with time. I have made use in the past of the British National Corpus for my master's thesis. I used it. There are very simple searches that you can do in the COCA corpus also. It's a very interesting corpus. Normally these databases and these resources give instructions for use. So they tell you how to make a search, how to combine searches. And the interesting thing is first to think about your research project, what you are interested in seeing. For instance, oh, I want to see how many iterations this word has, or I want to see if this word is used more frequently in combination with I don't know which other word, or in combination with this other word. I want to see how frequent this specific insult is used by TV comedians, or I want to see how much use this word is given in formal context or in an informal context, etc. The interesting thing of corpora is that we have all kinds of texts, and then you can see the source of the text. So the research questions that you can make to your are amazing. So amazingly big. There is so much choice. And I recommend you go, you check. And if you have some doubts and you have more interest in knowing how to make use of a specific lexicological or lexicographical resource, just write in the forum, and I will be happy to help. Okay, that was all by now. Thank you for watching till now. Bye.